Do you, Baron Frankenstein, take this woman to be your bride? Do you promise to haunt her with old horror movies, toys, and comics?
Yes, I want Fran. Woman. Fran.
And you, Baroness, do you take this man beast to be your lawfully bound husband? Do you promise to endure hours of unimaginable torture as he rambles about monster movies and long-dead actors? Close enough. Then by the power invested in me by Count Alucard, I now pronounce you supermates. You may bite or kiss the bride.
Hello and welcome to episode 39 of Supermates Husband and Wife Geekcast. I'm Chris.
I'm Cindy.
And I'm Awesome Andrew.
Yes, our son Andrew has rejoined us for this second trip to the House of Frankenstein this year. And we thought we would go from Hammer, which we covered last time, back to the Universal classics. And forget the Marvel Cinematic Universe. The first movie crossover happens right here. Not when Tony Stark walks into the bar at the end of The Incredible Hulk or none of that crap. This movie started the idea of a cinematic universe. Frankenstein meets the Wolfman.
True.
Yes. Yep. This is the first movie that links the Universal monster films together. Larry Talbot, the Wolfman, is the linchpin, and that's why I have my theory that I'm going to write my doctorate on, thesis on. That overall,
get your master's.
Yes.
Ooh.
Yes.
Just saying.
I have my bachelor's, but not my master's. That overall, he is the protagonist of this entire Universal Monster film series. Because he's the driving character in each film he's in from here on out, even in Abbott and Costello Meet the Wolf and Meet Frankenstein. I almost said Abbott and Costello Meet the Wolfman.
But honestly, that's more what it's about than Frankenstein.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's Abbott and Costello Meet Larry Talbot.
And you feel sympathetic for him.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
This is a sequel to the previous Wolfman and Frankenstein films. This is it's the second for the Wolfman and the fifth for the Frankenstein monster. Now, of course, Boris Karloff played the character in the first three films, and then Chaney played him in Ghost of Frankenstein, which was the previous film before this one. So just a quick update. When we last saw the Wolfman, in The Wolfman from 1941, Lawrence Talbot returns to his ancestral home of Llanwely, Wales, after years away. He reunites with his estranged father, Sir John Talbot, after the death of Larry's brother. While trying to save a woman from an attacking wolf, Larry is bitten, and he kills the wolf with his silver cane. Remember this. The wolf turns out to be a werewolf. Really, the gypsy fortune teller, Bela, played by Bela Lugosi. Mm-hmm. Remember him as well. Larry soon finds himself transforming into a werewolf himself. The town officials hunt what they believe to be a normal wolf, while Larry seeks help from Bela's mother, the gypsy Maliva. And not Velveeta.
Yeah. Dude, their macaroni and cheese is the bomb.
And not Belvita either, those biscuit things. The Wolfman attacks Larry's love interest, Gwen Conliff, but Sir John comes to her rescue, beating the beast to death with Larry's own silver-tipped cane. Irony. In death, the monster changes back to Sir John's son before his horrified eyes. The official story is Larry saved Gwen from the wolf, but died in the attempt.
But you forgot one thing.
What?
In the beginning, Larry was stalking Gwen.
I completely agree.
See, yeah. Supermates episode number, I don't know what the number is, but see the House of Frankenstein series last year when we covered the Wolfman.
Stalker.
And while I'm at it, the one reason we're covering this movie is I want to cover, because the Wolfman is the central character in the Monster Rally movies, I want to cover the rest of those from the Wolfman on. So next year we'll cover House of Frankenstein, and then the next year House of Dracula. So that's kind of my idea. So when we last saw the Frankenstein monster in Ghost of Frankenstein, Igor, played by Bela Lugosi, one-time assistant to Dr. Henry Frankenstein, although we never saw him assisting him, takes a revived monster, played by Lon Chaney Jr., to the town of Visaria, where he hopes that Henry's son Ludwig can help restore him to full strength. The brain-swapping plot lines that mar the later Universal Frankenstein films begin here, with Ludwig wanting to put the brain of his recently monster-murdered assistant in the body of the creature. The monster wants the brain of a young girl he befriended, to be put into his body, apparently not knowing he'll die if such a swap occurs. That is a really weird aspect to that film. It's just kind of...
That's creepy.
So he's wanting to put the brain of a girl that he met into his own body?
Yeah. He was Bruce Jenner years before.
You're gonna have to take that out.
Igor strikes a deal with Ludwig's bitter assistant, Dr. Bomer, and has his brain placed in the monster. Dr. Bomer was played by Lionel Atwell. Remember him. The monster, now speaking with Igor's voice, talks of world domination until he suddenly goes blind. Bomer didn't do his homework and forgot to match blood types, resulting in a blind monster.
Now, here's my question. The monster wants the brain of a young girl, so how did the young girl get killed?
She didn't die. The monster just abducted her, but they end up saving the girl at the end.
Okay.
He befriends her. He, like, she loses a rubber ball, and the monster goes and gets it for her, and he kills, like, several people that are trying to stop him, you know, and, yeah, it's, yeah.
But doesn't he realize that by having her brain in his head, A, it'll kill him, and two, it'll kill her?
She'll have to die to get her brain.
That's just dumb.
Nobody ever said he was dumb, you know. Igor, or Fritz, in the first movie, got the abnormal brain, you know, abnormal. The Igor monster, Dr. Frankenstein, and Bomer pay for their sins by burning up in the castle/sanitarium when it is set on fire. So now we can jump into the actual movie we're going to cover, Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, which was released on March 5th,
1943. Such a Halloween-y time of year.
Hardly any of these movies are released around Halloween.
Why not?
Which is still, to this day, that new Victor Frankenstein movie is coming out in November. Later November. You got built-in advertising with Halloween, people. What's wrong with you? Original screenplay by Kurt Siodmak, who wrote and created The Wolfman. So he's continuing on here. Directed by Roy William Neal. And it was actually produced by George Wagner, who directed the Wolfman film. Lon Chaney Jr., although credited as Lon Chaney only, plays Lawrence Talbot, a.k.a. the Wolfman, of course. Ilona Massey is Baroness Elsa Frankenstein. Patrick Knowles is Dr. Mannering. Lionel Atwill is the mayor. Bela Lugosi is the Frankenstein monster.
He plays everybody.
Maria Openskaya, I never can say her name, is Maliva.
Elvita.
And I can't say her name.
And she can't say Maliva. And Dennis Hoey is Inspector Owen.
Land Welly Wells. Under a full moon, two men walk through a lonely cemetery. They pause at the mausoleum marked Talbot. With some hesitation, they break into the crypt. There they find the vault of a man who, rumor has it, was buried with gold watch, ring, and money in his pockets. Lawrence Stuart Talbot. The men pry open the vault and find a layer of dried wolf's mane over the body. This causes one of the men, Freddie Jolly, to remember a poem known to seemingly everyone in Land Welly.
Even a man who's pure at heart and says his prayers by night may become a wolf when the wolfbane blooms and the moon is full and bright.
The beams of the full moon enter the tomb and shine on Talbot's body. The grave robbers note that Talbot is very well preserved, but this doesn't deter them from taking the gold ring from his finger. As they look over their ill-gotten prize by lantern light, a hand emerges from the coffin and grabs Jolly. Unable to escape the unholy grip, Jolly begs his friend to help him. Instead, the other man drops the lantern and runs away from the tomb, leaving his comrade to his own fate.
Pansy.
Sometime later in the town of Cardiff, a bobby finds an unconscious man in the street. Noting the nasty fracture on his head, the bobby calls for help. The next day, that man awakens in Queen's Hospital, seemingly none the worse for wear, much to the surprise of the surgeon who operated on him, Dr. Frank Mannering. Police Inspector Owen asked how he got that skull fracture, but the man can't remember. Or does he remember how he made it from his native Land Welly to Cardiff? He does remember his name, Lawrence Talbot.
Inspector Owen calls the police in Land Welly and finds out that Lawrence Talbot died 4 years ago. Owen believes their Talbot to be an imposter, but Dr. Mannering cautions him not to question him yet, due to his severe injury.
That night, the full moon creeps into Larry's hospital room, and once more, he transforms into the Wolfman. Escaping from the hospital and finding his usual set of clothes somehow, he attacks and murders the very bobby that helped Larry the night before. The next morning, Mannering finds an open window and a disheveled Larry in his room. Remembering what his bestial form has done, he asks Mannering to call the police, confessing he is a murderer. The doctor tries to calm him, telling him he must have overheard the nurses discussing the murder of the constable last night. Mannering assures him that the Bobby was killed by a wild animal, but Larry insists he becomes a wild animal, a wolf. And arriving Inspector Owen is just as incredulous.
Well, Mr. Talbot, you've decided to remember your real name?
Mr. Talbot seems to have heard about the unfortunate constable last night. It's disturbing him.
But he doesn't understand. There's a curse upon me. I change into a wolf.
It's a bit difficult to believe, my good man.
See that scar? That's where I was bitten by a wolf. Only it wasn't a real wolf. It was a man. A werewolf. I killed him. Now I change into a wolf at night when the moon is full. It's the truth. Ask Maliva, the old gypsy woman. She knows.
Maliva, gypsy?
Mr. Talbot, you must get back into bed.
Oh, are you blind? Won't you believe me? Help me.
Just tell us your real name. Let us do the worrying.
I told you, Lawrence Talbot. Lawrence Talbot. Why can't you understand?
Lawrence Talbot died 4 years ago.
Died? 4 years? Well, I did... I can't die.
Mr. Talbot, if you want us to help you, you must do as we say. Now, please lie down.
You think I'm insane? You think I don't know what I'm talking about? Well, you just look inside of that grave where Lawrence Talbot is supposed to be buried and see if you find a body in it.
Please get back into bed.
Yes, get on with it.
You're treating me like a lunatic. Well, you're as stupid as all the rest.
Believing him insane, Mannering has a fighting Larry placed into a straitjacket. The doctor and inspector head over to Lanwelly, where inside the Talbot crypt, they and the local police sergeant find the ravaged body of Freddie Jolly, but no Lawrence Talbot. Jolly seems to have been killed by an animal, just like the constable in Cardiff. The sergeant tells Owen and Mannering that a wolf had plagued the village years before, and that Sir John Talbot had accidentally murdered his son, thinking he was attacking the beast. Sir John died of grief shortly thereafter. Back at the local police station, Mannering and Owen examine a photo of Lawrence Talbot and find their man in Cardiff a near-perfect match. Mannering calls to check on his patient, only to learn he had escaped, having chewed through his straitjacket.
Sometime later, now onto the European continent proper, Larry walks into a gypsy village. There he finds the woman he had been searching for, Maliva, the woman who informed him of his curse, and the mother of the man who gave it to him, Bela. Maliva is understandably shaken to see Larry among the living.
What do you want from me?
Maliva, here I still carry the sign of the pentagram, the mark of the werewolf. I kill people. When the moon is full, I turn into a wolf.
It's not in my power to help you.
You're the only one that understands. Nobody else in the world will believe me. But you. You know. Your own son, Bela, was a werewolf. He attacked me. He changed me into a werewolf. He's the one that put this curse on me. Well, you watched over him until he was permitted to die. Well, now I want to die, too. Won't you show me the way?
I can't. But I will guard you and take care of you as I took care of my own son.
You are not leaving us. You are not going with him. He has the sign of the beast on him.
He is dangerous only when the moon is full. I shall watch over him.
He will murder you.
No. I shall take him to a place I know.
Where?
I know a man who has the power to help you.
Help me? Who?
For some time, Larry and Maliva travel the European countryside until arriving at the town of Visaria. Stopping at the local tavern, they ask about the whereabouts of a Dr. Frankenstein. The tavern owner, Vazic, angrily informs them not to mention that name in his town, and then tells them that Dr. Ludwig Frankenstein died in a fire that destroyed his sanitarium and the monster he harbored within. A despondent Larry realizes his only hope is now dashed. As Maliva and Larry move on from the village, a sullen Larry begins to succumb to his moonlight transformation and runs away.
Later that night, the townspeople walk through the street, with Vazic carrying the dead body of the tavern girl Larry noted earlier that night. Hearing the cry of a wolf, the townspeople chase the wolf man into the hills outside the village, onto the ruins of Frankenstein's castle. As the villagers approach, he falls through a rotten floor into an icy cavern below. The villagers do find Maliva, whom they take into custody.
The next morning, Larry awakens in the ice cave. Checking his surroundings, he finds what appears to be the body of a man beneath the ice. As he breaks the ice that surrounds him, Larry is stunned to find the frozen man to be Frankenstein's monster, who awakens as Larry frees him. Larry believes Frankenstein must have kept a journal and asked for the monster to show it to him. In the castle ruins, they find the secret compartment, but no journal. They do find a photo of Ludwig Frankenstein's daughter, Elsa. Larry believes she may be able to help him.
Acting as a Mr. Taylor, Larry contacts the mayor of Visaria about the whereabouts of Elsa Frankenstein. When the guarded mayor refuses to divulge the information, Larry tells him he is interested in buying the ravaged Frankenstein estate. The mayor sends for the Baroness, and her and Larry meet in the mayor's office. With the mayor gone, Larry tells her he is really only interested in her father's records. Given her family history, she refuses to divulge any information, saying the house burned down and the records with them. The mayor, unaware of the real situation, invites both the Baroness and Mr. Taylor to attend the town's festival of the new wine. Both agree, with Larry hoping he can convince Elsa to help him.
That night at the festival, Larry and Elsa's meeting is interrupted by a performer's musical number. His song about eternal life rattles Larry as Dr. Mannering finally tracks down his former patient.
Why have you followed me? Talbot, you're a murderer. Prove it. You're insane at times, and you know it. You're sane enough now, though, to know what you're doing. Why don't you let me take care of you?
Do you think it would do any good to put me in a lunatic asylum?
You know that's where you belong. It's the only thing to do.
No, that wouldn't do any good. I'd only escape again sooner or later.
But we might be able to cure you. Might prevent you.
I only want to die. That's why I'm here. If I ever find peace, I'll find it here. Now you understand. Why don't you help me?
Sit down.
Following reports of wolf attacks, Mannering had followed Larry across Europe. Now believing Larry's story, Mannering wants to take him back to England to help him. Larry insists only Dr. Frankenstein's journals hold the key to his salvation, a death he cannot escape from. Vazic, the belligerent tavern owner, overhears this conversation.
The festival is soon disrupted by the arrival of the monster, sending the entire town into a panic. Larry leads his frightening friend to a commandeered wagon, and the two make their escape, with the monster dropping wine barrels at the villagers chasing them. When the mayor returns empty-handed, Vazic attempts to stir the village into a frenzy. Bringing Maliva in, they question her, Mannering and Elsa. Mannering convinces them to let him handle the monster's destruction, not through violence, but scientific means. Wanting to rid her family of their curse, Elsa offers to lead him to the sanitarium ruins, where the monster and Larry are no doubt hiding.
The next morning, Mannering, Elsa, and Maliva convince Larry that they are sincere in trying to help him. Elsa even offers to find her father's journal. The monster isn't easily convinced, but Larry assures him that they are all friends and that Dr. Mannering will fully restore him. Elsa hopes this is only an act to gain the monster's trust. She finds her father's journal in a second secret compartment hidden behind the first. Her, Mannering, and Larry begin poring over the notes inside.
The secret of life and death.
Matter ages because it loses energy. This artificial body I have created has been charged with superhuman power so that its span of life will be extended. Its lifetime will equal the lives of more than 100 human beings. This, my creation, can never perish unless... unless its energies are drained off artificially by changing the poles from plus to minus.
But that's the secret of life. What good does it do me? I'm not interested in life. I wasn't created artificially. I'm a human being. I've got real blood in my veins. What can we do to end my life?
Energy which cannot be destroyed can be transmitted.
Well, if that's the case, then the energies from my body can be drained off also. Dr. Frankenstein must have performed his experiments in this room. With these machines. They don't seem to have been destroyed by the fire. You must fix them and help me be rid of this thing that keeps me alive eternally.
When you were talking to the monster, I was afraid you meant what you said.
What did I say?
You said you'd help him.
Of course I can't. I mustn't.
As the project progresses, the villagers discuss the going on, with the mayor believing they should be left alone to do their work. Bassick has other ideas, with a plan to destroy the nearby dam and flood the ruins. The mayor chalks this diabolical plan up to too much drink and walks away.
With the equipment now up and running, an anxious Larry begs Mannering to hurry as a full moon is due to rise. Elsa is concerned that the doctor is wavering in his desire to drain the monster of his life. That night, Mannering places both the monster and Larry on lab tables, but like many scientists before him, he cannot bring himself to destroy the monster, instead resolving to give him full power. He switches the polarity of the wires and activates the machines. Elsa is awakened by a familiar sound. Somehow knowing what Mannering is up to, she begs him to stop, pulling a switch as he warns her against it. The switch causes an overload, which further wrecks the building. Meanwhile, Vasek makes good on his threat and sets dynamite on the dam.
In the chaos, everyone seems to forget about the full moon, and its beams awaken a sedated Larry, who transforms once again into the Wolfman. A fully revived monster attacks Mannering and grabs Elsa, but the Wolfman tackles him. As the two terrors tussle among the lab equipment, Mannering and Elsa make their escape, just as Vasek lights the fuse and blows the dam. Locked in mortal, or is that immortal, combat, the two beasts are washed away as the remnants of the sanitarium crumble beneath the deluge.
Finish him.
Wolfman wins. Fatality. Okay. Okay, before we get into the actual what we saw of this movie, we have to discuss what we didn't see in this movie. It was severely edited after filming, so studio interference is nothing new. So Josh Trank, that directed the Fantastic Four movie, can whine all he wants. This has been going on for at least 70 years. Chaney was originally going to play both the monster and the Wolfman, because he had played them both in the previous films of each franchise. They were going to use trick photography and doubles, but it was decided that the makeup alone would be too time-consuming, because, right, you know, they crank these things out pretty quick. Bela Lugosi had turned down the role in 1931 due to the lack of dialogue and apparently the amount of makeup that he'd have to be under. He supposedly shot a test with the original director, Robert Flory, that some say resulted in Flory being fired from the project and Lugosi just walked away from it. And so then they cast Boris Karloff, and the rest is history, which of course made Boris Karloff, who probably, you know, it, some people say, much to Lugosi's chagrin, it's more a legend than fact.
Right.
He got continuous work where Lugosi struggled, you know.
Right.
The footage of that test is apparently lost to the ages, so. Lugosi was hired for this film based on the end of Ghost of Frankenstein, where Chaney's monster spoke with Lugosi's voice, now that Igor's brain was in the monster's body. Since Chaney couldn't do both roles, and the Wolfman was his baby, as he called him, Lugosi was the next logical choice, despite the fact that he was 60 years old at the time and not up for the physical challenges, which means that he was like almost 50 when he played Dracula.
Right.
I mean, that's hard to imagine, that he was almost 50 the first time he played, well, in the movie.
Right.
He played Dracula on stage several years before, but As written in film, Lugosi's monster did speak, as with Igor's voice. But there are two theories as to why every line of dialogue, and as a result, many of his scenes were cut. The writer, Kurt Siodmak, said that Lugosi's delivery came across as laughable. He called it Hungarian funny. Which not intentionally funny, but Hungarian funny. But most historians believe it had to do with the fact that with his accent and uttering lines about world domination, this was in the middle of World War II. And, you know, audiences didn't want that in the middle of their fantasy movie. So either way, they cut the crap out of it. There are stills that show the monster and Larry conversing around a fire they build in the ice cave after Larry frees him. But the actual cut footage is apparently lost. They apparently tried to find it about 20 years ago, and they like searched everywhere that they
would be logical.
I guess when they started releasing these on video, they really started their home video series. So yeah.
And when I first saw him tearing out the monster from the ice, I was like, "Whoa, that's a different guy."
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, that's we're gonna get to that. Another aspect is the monster's blindness is also forgotten in this film, in the release version, but it explains why Lugosi is, you know, he's got that robotic stance with his arms extended and he's groping around. Well, the reason he was doing that is because he was blind.
Right.
But everybody from then on just said, oh, that's how Frankenstein's monster walks. So that became the Frankenstein walk. And Karloff and Chaney never walked like that as the monster.
No.
So that, you know, it's just kind of like the way that Igor really wasn't the hunchbacked assistant. He was the broken neck assistant. And Fritz was the hunchback assistant. But they merged in the public consciousness. And Andrew's right. When Larry frees the monster, it's very obviously not Bela Lugosi. It's Gil Perkins, who was a stuntman as well as an actor. Him and Eddie Parker fill in for Lugosi, probably covering up some of the scenes that he filmed where he was talking, but also because he just wasn't up to the physical requirements, especially dragging Ilona Massey around, you know, and stuff like that. According to IMDb, with these cuts, Lugosi is only on screen for 5 minutes and 6 seconds.
Dang.
Yeah. So Frankenstein meets the abbreviated, the abbreviated Frankenstein meets the Wolfman.
So is that the Frankenstein monster or Lugosi the actor?
Lugosi the actor, yeah. So let's get into the movie itself. I like the opening credit sequence with the beaker and the words come out of the bubble. That's kind of neat. Although most people point out this is the first Frankenstein movie that doesn't have a Dr. Frankenstein. It's got Elsa Frankenstein, and it's got Dr. Mannering acting like a Frankenstein type, but some people think this is where you begin to get the confusion if Frankenstein's the monster or the scientist. So,
right.
That opening scene in the graveyard, that's like one of the best in all the Universal horror films, and it's certainly the most eerie. Like we said, when we were watching it.
All three of us were like, oh, it's just like from the Haunted Mansion.
Yeah.
All three of us said that from Disney World.
Yes. You know, when you come around that curve and you get into the graveyard and the groundkeeper's shaking with his dog and, you know.
Yeah, holding the lantern.
Yeah, holding the lantern. Yeah, that's what it reminds you of. It's really cool. Now, I know we had some discussion about just who was buried in the tombs inside the crypt.
Yes.
But I took a closer look at it while I was doing the notes. The Larry's tomb is in the center of which we'll get into. Larry's tomb is in the center of the room, though. In a later scene, Sir John's tomb is said to be over to the right as you walk into the crypt. But why is Larry's in the middle of the crypt? I mean, why would he be there versus Sir John? I mean, I can kind of see almost like they're in state, like a president or something.
Right.
The person that most recently died is there.
But they said Sir John died after
because
maybe
he killed Larry.
There because they couldn't get the wolf's bane around him, and they wanted everyone to know that he's the wolf man, so he's right in the middle.
I don't know.
But still, yet the whole thing. Maybe it was one of those cases. Sir John felt, you know,
he wanted Larry left there in the middle.
Yeah.
But then what about there being, you know, the Larry in the tomb and the Larry on the side?
Well, there was another Sir John.
Well, there was a John Talbot who seems to have a date from 1850 or 1830 something. You can kind of make that out. And there's a Lawrence and Annie Talbot buried in the crypt underneath the first, that John. Because we thought, oh, the later on, the sergeant says Sir John's buried over here, over his shoulder, while he's looking where it said John Talbot already.
Right.
But that's apparently a previous John Talbot. Now, I believe, I didn't go back and rewatch it, I believe Larry's brother, who has died at the beginning of The Wolfman and the reason Larry comes home, was named John. I think he was like...
The first brother, the first son.
John the second, or maybe the third or something, according to this. But yeah, he was the oldest son. So yeah, lots of Talbots buried in there. It's kind of confusing.
Yep.
So if Sir John buried Larry with the wolfsbane over him, then why didn't he secure the body as best he could? I mean, why didn't he bury him far, far away where anybody could, you know? I mean, he took the precaution to bury him with the wolfsbane over top of him because he knew, you know, he and Maliva were probably the only two, and maybe Gwen because she witnessed it. The rest of them just kind of assumed that he, you know, just like they said that, you know, he accidentally killed Larry trying to stop the wolf, save Gwen, and Sir John in the fog killed Larry. So it just, you know, makes you wonder why he didn't secure him more. Of course, if he had, we wouldn't have had a movie. So,
well, true.
The shot of the moon when it lights up Chaney's face in the coffin, partially covered by the wolfsbane, is nice and creepy. It's really cool. And then there's the hand. He's got like long fingernails. Fingernails still growing. Well, he's kind of dead.
Dead then his fingernails.
He's only mostly dead, but.
Princess Bride.
It does make you wonder, though, why the hand didn't start to change into the Wolfman.
Uh-huh.
So, because the moon was on him. Because
he's been dead for so long, and now it just came off, so it takes him a long time.
Takes him a while to warm up.
Yeah.
Maybe. Now, Dr. Mannering is played by Patrick Knowles, who played Frank Andrews in The Wolfman. He was the...
love interest.
The fiancé of Gwen that she quickly forgets when Larry strolls into town.
He's a lettuce man.
And he was the groundskeeper. He was loaded. It's like, forget you. It seems Larry doesn't remember much about the Wolfman experience at first until he transforms again. Because he, you know, he remembers he's Larry and he's from Lanwelly and that's about it. He doesn't remember Diane or anything.
Well, to make a comic book connection, it's sort of like Jason Todd when he first comes back. He doesn't remember exactly who he is until he pulls the Robin move on that guy in the alleyway. What? I just making connections.
You would invoke some Judd Winnick up in this episode.
Continue.
But good point, though. It says Larry died 4 years ago, but these movies are only 2 years apart. So I wonder why they upped the time frame on this. I mean, because what does 2 years really gain you, you know?
Well, it might just be that, you know, they wanted it to seem like there was 2 years isn't that long.
I don't know. Dead's dead. But, I don't know. The transformation scene in Larry's bed is one of the best in the series. It's near perfect. And I understand they actually cast they made a plaster pillow with a casting of Chaney's head, so his head would rest in there perfectly. And then Jack Pierce applied the makeup, and they, you know, shoot a little bit, and he'd apply more makeup just like they always did, but that way his head stayed almost completely still.
And that's cool.
And this is the first time we actually see Larry's face as he changes into the Wolfman. In the first movie we saw his feet change.
Yeah.
And then he changed back at the end, but we never saw him change into the Wolfman. And we get it like three times in this one, so they're making up for lost time. And to me, the Wolfman's makeup looks its best in this one.
He's more hairy.
Yeah, he's got more hair around his face. But in the next one, in House of Frankenstein...
I still say I don't care for the nose on this
one. It's the same nose.
I'm allowed to have my opinion.
Well, okay. In the next one, he's got like a longer, almost like ZZ Top-like beard. And then in the last, in the House of Dracula, he's got his, they had a shortage of yak fur due to World War II, so he's got a more cropped look about his wolfiness. So he goes, he's you know, he's in his hippie years in House of Frankenstein, and he kind of like, he grows up and, you know, he's got to get a job, so he gets clean, shaved.
And that House of Dracula, did he have that pencil-thin mustache?
Yes. The Boston Black Ick kind. Oh, see.
Man, that thing was pathetic.
Yeah, that was his, that was the thing. He had those in those Inner Sanctum movies.
Anyway,
which
back to what we're talking about.
Okay.
I like it when the Wolfman, the short little scene where they show him bounding about in the town. He's like jumping up on the crates and things. That's cool.
That's cool.
And now we get to the part that I know Andrew always loves, because somehow Larry finds his traditional Wolfman attire.
Yes.
And then when he turns back, he's back in his
jammies.
So wait, this big old dog standing on its legs is like, oh, I gotta change my clothes.
I'm going to have fun.
Yeah. I'm changing the clothes and jumps out the freaking window and goes gallivanting around. And then when he shows back up, he's in those clothes and no one wonders why in the crap he's got different clothes on.
Well, it gets better later on. Of course, throughout this film, Chaney gets to have several of those explosive scenes that he does so well, where he just blows up on people. He roughs up the orderlies in the hospital. He slaps away Vazic's hand, and he gets a hold of that annoying singer in the village later. You know, this is just me personally, but, you know, this type of acting, this really emotive, explosive acting, would be popular in about 10 years with guys like James Dean and Marlon Brando. Mm. But, I mean, you didn't see a lot of Hollywood types doing this at the time. I mean, so I think he was kind of ahead of the curve and didn't get recognized for that a lot. Chaney's dog, which I think was named Bruno as well, appears in the camp scene and later with the Angry Villagers. He was also the wolf that bit Larry in the first film. He's a German Shepherd that I think he was just hanging around the set and Chaney took him in. So the first scene between Larry and Maliva is really powerful and really well done. Chaney and Ospenskaya have a really great mother-son chemistry, which was kind of weird considering that, you know, he killed her son. But
I know.
But I mean, you know, it's like she's like, hey, you know. unfortunately, after that scene, she's mostly wasted, especially after the monster enters the picture.
Right.
I mean, that's...
It's, you know, after they reach the village, it's pretty much she didn't really need to be in the picture.
And I kind of wish she hadn't considered, which we'll get into later, but if you think about it. So now here's where I become Logic Lad instead of Logic. You're Logic Lass, but I'm going to be Logic Lad, or, you know, fill in for this time. I almost hate to bring this up, but Larry's like, I just want to die. I want to die. Okay. Well, Larry died the first time by being hit in the head with a cane, a silver tip cane.
Uh-huh.
That's how he also killed Bela, but Bela they act like Bela's dead.
Right. Yeah, but how did Larry come back to life if he's dead?
Right, exactly. So, you know, apparently they buried Bela in the correct fashion and buried him in a way that nobody's going to disturb his tomb.
Or find him.
Why not just take something silver, bash Larry in the head with it again? Or stick a silver sword through him and then bury him properly.
Silver serving trays.
Yes.
Yeah, dude.
And kill the poor, you know what? Before it's, you know, and let him die in peace and bury. I guess maybe he wants to be absolutely sure he can't come back. I guess that's what amounts to. Plus, again, we wouldn't have any movie. Vazic is an ass from the get go. I mean, they walk in, he just treats him like crap. You know, I mean, he's like, get out of here. You know, and of course, Larry blows up on him.
But I think it's also interesting, even though Larry is so tortured and he's like, oh my gosh, I'm a murderer, but he finds time to check out the girl lighting the lamps.
Yeah.
She's like, yeah, I'm going to get me a piece of that later.
Just say hi, bye-bye. that girl in the tavern, I've seen her referred to as Vazic's daughter. I think he'd be even more bat crap crazy, because he never takes it to a personal level like they killed my daughter, he killed my daughter, you know, or anything like that. He's, you know, I think she was just a tavern worker. If somebody knows something that I don't, write in and tell me, but I've heard both, but I don't see any evidence that says she really is. When Chaney finds out that Frankenstein's dead, he plays that scene very well. You really do feel like he's completely out of hope at this point, and he's just despondent. It's interesting that the Wolfman, he never attempts to turn on Maliva. I mean, that one guy even says, he'll murder you, you know, in the camp. And she's like, I will take care of him. But he runs away when he starts to change, and he doesn't come back around, Which is interesting because in the first movie they say the werewolf kills what he loves best and and different things like that, or that's part of the legend. And who else has he got? So I guess maybe because he, kind of took a shine to that girl, he turned around and killed her, but so I don't know. The villager in the hat who has a lot of expositional dialogue is a character named Rudy, and he's actually played by Dwight Frye. Frye was Renfield in Dracula. He played Fritz and Carl in Frankenstein and The Bride of Frankenstein, respectively. He actually was, like we said before, Fritz was the prototype of the classic Igor character that everybody thinks of as the hunchback lab assistant.
Right.
And he was actually killed by the monster in both of those films. So it was like, it's surprised Dwight Frye didn't, the monster didn't pick him up and throw him off something in this one. But he didn't. When the villagers are coming after him, I thought it was cool that the wolf man, you get to see him act very wolf-like and, make growly faces at the Adam. I thought that was cool. So it shows that the makeup actually, works.
Gives him a chance to emote more.
Yeah, it works that way. Now, did you guys think the Wolfman got shot before he fell into the cave? Okay. I couldn't tell because you hear a gunshot go off and he kind of drops, but then he gets back up and he's not holding an arm or anything.
Yeah.
He's like super healing power, son.
But then he falls into that cavern and he does that thing. He's trying to get out, but then he does that thing where he just rolls around, which is kind of...
Yes,
no. Yeah, I mean, it's like a dog when you take them out and they see snow. They're like, yay, it's snow. Exactly.
You're going to make a snow angel.
It reminded me of Sugar.
So, but if he got shot, then I kind of understand why he was falling around. And then when Larry wakes up later, he's got a rip in his shirt, but I know he would heal fast if it's not a silver bullet, which is, still hasn't been introduced into this series yet. That's the next movie, which, we're getting bits and pieces of the legend. But now, Andrew, what happens?
Somehow, when Larry freaking wakes up, he's got flipping shoes on.
And socks.
I mean, what the crap, dude? There was just shoes and socks laying down there or something.
And the perfect size.
Yeah, and the perfect freaking size.
Maybe he did what, Spider-Man, used to web his clothes up in, in the corner of the building or something.
How the crap would he do that? Take his poop and rub it everywhere?
Oh, God. All right. I just meant he put them somewhere where he could find them again.
Oh, okay.
God. I'm going to cut that part out.
No.
As we said earlier, that's not Lugosi being pulled out of the ice, but Gil Perkins. And you can really tell that Lugosi's monster is supposed to be blind when you first see him, because Larry's literally leading him around the ruins, by hand. And I thought it's interesting. His monster is very hand gestury, like his Dracula. Like when he opens up that compartment behind that bookcase and he's like, rah, and puts that hand out like real, he's got the Steve Ditko fingers going on in his hand, So it's
kind of... Well, I mean, there's some people that just talk a lot with their hands.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know.
He freaking knocked me out one time.
We don't want to put this on recording.
Okay.
Now, the character of Elsa was played in Ghost of Frankenstein by Evelyn Ankers.
Evelyn.
No, it's Evelyn.
Really?
Yeah, I said it wrong before. She had played Gwen in The Wolfman. It's supposedly the studio thought her role was too prominent in the first film to have her as a different character in this one. But I wish they had, because I'm not a real big fan of Ilona Massey's performance. She's very in the moment. I mean, some scenes she's downright happy. She's like, I can take you to the ruins. And she's got this big smile on her face. Like, why are you happy? It's like, why are you smiling? At what point do you start realizing, oh crap, there's a lot of bad crap going around. My dad's monster's loose. He's like, or grandpa's monster's loose. He's tearing up the town. He killed a bunch of people before, but I'm going to, use my Marlena Dietrich thick accent, which was real. She was Hungarian.
So how long ago were the events of this Frankenstein monster supposed to have happened?
My theory is that the original Frankenstein, Bride of Frankenstein, happened in the late 1800s. Even though the story was written in the early 1800s, because now they're dressed just appeared more it wasn't that out of date, you know? Mm-hmm. And then you had his Henry's son, Wolf, inherit the castle in Son of Frankenstein. That's one where you're introduced to Igor and Karloff plays the monster for the last time. And then in the next movie, Ghost of Frankenstein with Chaney, then you see his second son, Ludwig, who's older than Wolf but didn't inherit the castle, which is kind of weird. so, you know, I'm guessing they was in the late 1800s and now, because that would give time for Wolf and Ludwig to be born and be the age they were in modern times of 1942
to 3. Well, I'm just trying to figure out because, you know, you talk about, she talks about, you know, my childhood and that haunts me and blah, blah, blah. But
yeah.
Would that have fit timeline-wise?
Well, she, Ludwig and his, apparently his wife who died earlier and his daughter moved to Visaria from the village of Frankenstein. Apparently due to, you know, all the, or they weren't in, I guess Henry Frankenstein left at some point because the castle had been empty when Wolf Frankenstein comes to it in Ghost of Frankenstein, if I remember correctly.
But what? She seems too old for that to have been in her childhood.
Well, not really.
Okay.
I mean, you know, if it was in the, I mean, if, well, I see what you're saying. I see, yeah, I can, she's a little, yeah, because she seems older than Evelyn Ankers, but, well, you know, whatever.
She seems at least in her mid to late 20s.
Yeah, so.
And so that, for that to be in her childhood, that would mean the events of when her father created the monster.
Well, he didn't create the monster, he just revived the original
whatever.
Monster. Well, I'm just saying it's the same monster. It's the same monster.
But still, yet, for it to be her childhood,
yeah,
would have been, had to have been at least 10 or 15 years previously.
They all lived away from the town of Frankenstein when they grew up, I guess, because Wolf didn't know about any of the, he had never been there before, so I'm guessing Henry Frankenstein and whatever his wife's name was left the village of Frankenstein after the events of Bride. And then Wolf came back and inherited the family castle and son in 1939, while at some point Ludwig had and his family had set up in Visaria, and he was a doctor there with the sanitarium and everything. So, and she was probably raised in Visaria. That's why she knows of the festival, the new wine, and all that stuff.
Then why do the villagers act like they don't know her?
Well, they do know her, but they didn't know about the Frankenstein deal. They didn't think the Frankensteins. They didn't know anything about the curse of the Frankensteins and the monster and all that till Igor and the monster showed up in Ghost of Frankenstein.
Anyway.
So. Did you all get all that? Just want to make sure. Yeah. Because I didn't.
We weren't supposed to be covering Ghost of Frankenstein, but we've almost covered it as much as Frankenstein meets the Wolfman.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, Lionel Atwill, who plays the mayor, he was a mainstay in Frankenstein films. He played Inspector Krogh and Son of, the guy with the wooden arm that Kenneth Mars rips on in Young Frankenstein. He played Dr. Bomer in Ghost of Frankenstein, and who was the one that helped Igor do the brain swap, and he'll show up again in House of Frankenstein as well, as all his different characters, which is just really confusing. So what did you guys think of the musical number in this film?
I fell asleep during that part.
How could you fall asleep?
I'm real good about not listening when I don't want to.
Yeah, we can tell.
Yeah. You know, it's kind of fun, but it just seems out of place. It goes on too long. If it was just like a couple lines, it'd been okay. The singer is apparently a Russian bass singer named Adia Kuznetsov.
Don't even try to say it.
So, well, yeah. I did, so.
Kuznetsov.
But I do Kuznetsov. It says Kuznetsov.
K-U-Z-E-N-T-Z-O-F-F.
Kuznetsov. Yeah. But Larry gets to do what we've always wanted to see people do in a musical number, break it up. You know, shut up! Stop singing!
Every single one of those high school musical things that Danny loves, my little sister, I just want to go, shut up! No!
Why are you breaking out into song?
Yeah, I mean, what the crap? And the principals are all like, yeah, let's do this.
That's why I like Enchanted when they start singing in the park, and he's like, why is everybody singing? What? Does everybody know this song? I've never heard of this song before. You know, hits it head on, so then I like it because it's like, oh, it's cute, you know.
Anyway.
Of course, the monster, you know, he's just going out for a stroll, and everybody freaks out, you know. He's just. you know, he's a poor handicapped dude, you know, blind guy out for a stroll, and everybody flips shit. Cause,
dude,
you know,
don't make it sound like... Now, Larry was so concerned about Mr. Frankenstein, the monster or whatever. Why wasn't he locked up or something? No, he just let him go. Oh, you go around and you do your business outside and you come back in whenever you want to. Yeah. Well, Wolfman was rolling around in the snow.
So. Yeah. Yeah. What, again, I'm sorry. Elsa, she reminds me of Madeline Kahn in Blazing Saddles. I know it's, they're both like doing their Marlena Dietrich bird, but it's just, I mean, she's okay in some scenes, but others, she's just like, when she starts getting on Frank about, no, you're not really going to try to revive this creep, are you? You know, but there's other times where she's just way too damn happy in the middle of all this going on. And then, of course, you know, Mannering's got to do the quick change to all of a sudden want to revive the monster. As soon as he sees the monster, he's like, I can make that work. You know, it's like, I mean, they tie it into the vicious cycle that all these scientists have run into. She even says, you know, it destroyed my grandfather, destroyed my father. You know, don't let it destroy you, basically. But, you know, it makes you wonder if in the unedited film, what was Igor... like telling him, like was there scenes with him and Bela Lugosi where he's like, you know, you need to revive me or something, you know, like, yeah, like trying to convince him to do it. Because, you know, what it makes you wonder, what does Igor think, the monster, think about what's going on? Are they telling him? Well, you know, does he have a indication that they're going to zap him of all of his energy and kill him? Or, you know, I mean, if you think about that, if you think the monster as film really wasn't a dumb idiot, yeah, you know, then it's like, okay, how does this work? How much of this movie is cut out? You know, because it's actually fairly, it's like a minute, it's an hour and 14 minutes, which for a Universal movie isn't bad for that time. So, I don't know. So, I'm also confused. Is he draining Larry's life force off and giving it to the monster? Because he changes the wires when he decides.
Right.
So I'm a little confused. You know, of course, it's like mumbo jumbo pseudoscience. You know, when we get to House of Frankenstein, there's so much brain swap talk going on. It makes absolutely no sense.
I'm just like, have a margarita in one hand and enjoy the ride.
Yeah, that's right. You can't overthink that, this type of stuff. And of course, every Frankenstein lab comes with that switch. Or that lever.
Frank! You're making him strong again. Frank! Stop it! Stop the machine, Frank!
Don't pull that switch!
Don't touch that lever. That will blow everything to hell.
Why is it even there?
Why would they put that in there?
It's like Dr. Doofenshmirtz on Phineas and Ferb.
Yeah, it's like, why do I put that destruction button in there every time?
You know, and he puts it there every single freaking time. And then sometimes we'll have this little sign, push this button.
Yeah. Well, that's why, because movies like this do that. And Frank's like, don't touch that switch. And she already did. And really all it did was overload things and make a couple timbers fall. It didn't really do a whole lot. Yeah. Like it didn't blow everything up. It'd been kind of funny if it blew everything up and the dude was sitting there holding the dynamite and Vosick's like, well, crap. And it blows up and he's got the match in his hand and the dynamite. So he's like, oh, shit. And they both.
Dad.
Christopher.
He had it coming. I didn't like that guy. Of course, you can see that Lugosi is replaced by Perkins and Eddie Parker again when he's hauling Alona Massey around, like I said.
What did you think about her hair? I mean, just all the way down to her ankles, you know, big braid.
Lady Godiva. Yeah,
yeah. I expected her to go take one and start twirling it or something.
Yeah.
Well, you know, maybe Elsa, if she'd told Frank to let it go.
Let it go, let it go. When I rise like the break of dawn.
Let it go.
Oh, holy.
She could build ice castles for the Wolfman to frolic around in, and he'd been happy. You know, just frolic around the snow.
That'd be freaking awesome. I would love that, just to roll around in snow all day.
Just next topic.
Freeze the monster again. So, I'm guessing that Maliva died in the castle in the flood as well, because we don't see her again. She was in the castle right before the final experiment was starting. So why the crap did Mannering get off so easy? He gets to leave with Elsa.
Uh-huh.
We, in the first film, Henry Frankenstein got out. He originally was supposed to die, but, you know, in his hospital, in his bed, and back inside his, inside the Frankenstein estate, he's okay. In the next movie, you see him in the lab when it blows up, but then they shoot a scene of Colin Clive, you know, at, you know, looking up at the castle as it crumbles, you know, so that they, he's had last minute reprieves every time.
Right.
So now the only one that bit the dust was Ludwig Frankenstein and Ghost. And he was really actually one of the most altruistic, because he wanted to put the monster had killed his assistant, and he wanted to put his brain into the monster's body and bring him back.
Back, right.
So, I mean, he was probably the least, you know, he actually had psychotic. Good intentions anyway. He was, yeah, exactly.
He was the least psychotic.
Yeah. So poor Maliva, she buys it, but Dr. Mannering walks away, so I call BS.
Boy Scouts.
Yeah, no. in their next appearance, both the Wolfman and the monster are found playing Captain America on ice again. Just saying.
Captain America on ice.
Captain America on ice. We kind of saw that. Yeah. They weren't on ice, but it was the Marvel Live thing.
That thing was awesome.
Now, me personally, I really enjoy the Wolfman parts of this film. I think it's the first part of the movie is a great sequel to The Wolfman. I think the film suffers a bit once Larry finds the monster, and it's probably a lot of it's due to the fact that...
And the editing.
All the editing, yeah. I still enjoy it, but the first half is definitely the better part of the movie, and the rest is... It's fun, but you're venturing slightly into that fun but brain-dead territory of the next two, next two movies. The Monster Rally films, which we'll get to next time. So you guys got anything else on this one?
On the movie, no.
Nope. Well, I think we'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll discuss our comic, which has one of these type monsters fighting. Yes, again, it's Batman.
Hey, Michael.
Hey, Dad.
We need to record another new trailer.
Another one?
Yes. You know that we read comics and then talk about comics, because as we've established, talking about comics you've not read is just dumb.
Yeah, and you make me do it every Thursday.
Well, we've moved.
Have we?
Yes, we have outgrown our old location.
I don't feel like I've moved.
And we have now moved to twotruefreaks.com.
What was that again?
Twotruefreaks.com. Hey, Kids Comics, still every Thursday at twotruefreaks.com.
Okay, we're back, and we're going to talk about Batman number 255 from March-April 1974, according to Mike's Amazing World of Comics, on sale December 28th, 1973, which is, of course, another non-Halloween release date for you.
Yep.
So
makes you think if maybe the script was late and they were publishing it a little
later.
Well,
you got to figure at this time, the horror, this is getting toward the end of it, but the horror craze was on in comics. I mean, almost all DC comics, like every other comic, had some kind of horror tinge to it. The covers,
so it didn't
had,
necessarily wasn't
yeah the
calendar based.
The loosening of the comics code, that was something new for it to explore. The DC horror titles, House of Mystery, and those were selling really well, and Marvel had Tomb of Dracula and Werewolf by Night and all those that were selling really well at the time. So I guess it at this point it wasn't as big of a deal to do a monster story at Halloween. So, anyway, this was actually one of DC's 100-page spectaculars. They usually consisted of a new story, which would be this one, and related reprints. And Batman had actually gone bi-monthly to accommodate this change a lot of DC comics had at the time. The story we are interested in is represented by a large vignette drawn by Neil Adams showing Batman chained to a construction site as a werewolf leaps at him from a nearby crane. The blurb reads, "A new Batman shocker, Moon of the Wolf."
Dun, dun, dun.
The other stories are represented by vignettes drawn by Nick Carty with an overall blurb, "Meet the Batman Family." And we've got Batman's Father, which shows Thomas Wayne in the Bat costume.
Cue Brady, the Brady Bunch theme song.
Here's a story of a lovely lady who was shot in an alley and her pearls went everywhere.
No! No!
Okay, I'm horrified. No. No.
No.
Oh,
go.
Sorry.
Oh, you killed it. You killed her.
Sorry. I'm punchy. So meet them.
I'm disappointed in you.
Oh, come on.
This happens a lot.
Meet the Batman family. Batman's father, which shows Thomas Wayne the Batman suit, as I said. Alfred the detective, which is Alfred in a deerstalker hat and a pipe like Sherlock Holmes. Batgirl's big surprise, which is Batman.
She's pregnant.
Who's the father? Is it Batman or Robin? It's according to which continuity we're in. Batgirl's big surprise, it shows Batman unmasking in front of Batgirl. And Robin battles Crazy Quilt, which shows Crazy Quilt blasting Robin with his helmet that, you know, shows all the different light. And I will say that I have plans to cover one of these stories in an upcoming episode. Hmm. But I won't say which. So, there. You know what I'm talking about. Thank you. Don't you? We talked about it before, but you may have forgotten.
Yeah, I forgot.
Okay.
I'm like giving him this puzzle. What?
Yeah, because we did talk about it. It's not like I just, you know, it's like, we're going to cover this and then not, you know.
Why is that any different than any other time?
Oh, okay. So the story, this story was actually several people last time said, why didn't you cover this? Well, because I wanted to mix things up last time because I'd already had a couple of Batman stories. We've already had Batman in the previous one, but this is a Batman solo story. So Moon of the Wolf is by Len Wein, writer. Neil Adams and Dick Giordano, artists, and Julia Schwartz, editor.
Night in Gotham City. Janet Boner, secretary, prepares for a good night's sleep. Unbeknownst to her, a sinister assailant spies on her from outside her high-story window. And unbeknownst to the peeping Tom, Batman is watching him.
The villain enters Boner's window. The toughened city girl isn't shaken much by his appearance, that of a very convincing werewolf costume. She orders her dog to attack, but the werewolf snaps its spine. Ooh. As he moves on to Janet, the Batman makes a dramatic entrance through the window, knocking the prowler to the floor. The werewolf responds by grabbing Janet and throwing her out of her window. Like a well-oiled spring, Batman leaps after her and manages to catch her in one hand while throwing a well-aimed bat rope with another. Swinging onto a nearby rooftop, Batman has saved the girl despite dislocating his shoulder and losing track of his furry opponent.
Later that evening, the Dark Knight pays a visit to Police Commissioner Gordon. Batman asks Gordon if he knows anything about a burglar in a werewolf mask. Gordon does have news of a possibly related case, two Alaskan timber wolves stolen from the Gotham Park Zoo a few weeks ago. Batman agrees the crimes may be related and has a frightening thought.
What if that guy wasn't wearing a mask?
In a grimy pharmacy in Gotham's notorious Lower East Side, the feral prowler confronts a man in a white lab coat with a Moe Howard haircut. The man counts on his stopwatch as the werewolf goes from beast to man before his eyes, proving this is no mere disguise. The sinister scientist, Professor Milo, is withholding the cure to the other man's werewolfism. This tortured man, Anthony Lupus, recalls the events that brought him to this lowly state. How he was an Olympic decathlon champion, how his athletic and financial successes could not compensate for the pain he felt from the ever-increasingly painful headaches he developed. How after exhausting all medical avenues that offered him no relief, Lupus showed up at Milo's door. Milo's potions worked, and the headaches stopped, but on the nights of the full moon, Anthony Lupus exchanged one horror for another, far worse. He became a werewolf.
After his first transformation, Lupus confronted Milo. The mad doctor knew full well his serums would accelerate Lupus's latent lycanthropy, of which his headaches were a symptom. Using serums extracted from the blood of the Alaskan timberwolves, Milo had created the perfect weapon to turn loose on his old foe, the Batman. Milo offered Lupus a choice, the cure for his disease in return for him ending Batman's life.
In the present, Milo tells Anthony of his plan to lure Batman into the werewolf's den, a plan that involves not the beast, but Anthony Lupus himself.
Several days later, at an upscale athletic club, Anthony Lupus shares a workout session with Bruce Wayne. Lupus tells Wayne of his new tax shelter plan. Donate $250,000 to Batman's favorite charity in exchange for meeting the man in person. Lupus is a bit concerned about how he'll get in contact with Batman, but Bruce assures him that Batman will get wind of the offer and make an appearance.
Shortly thereafter, Batman makes good on Lupus's offer and appears at his home. Lupus offers Batman a drink as he closes the door to his study, but Batman isn't interested in pleasantries. The ever-alert Cape Crusader begins to notice how the room seems hot, and he surmises something is amiss before passing out, before a guilt-stricken Lupus. The poison air worked when Batman refused the drug drink.
Later that night, as a storm rolls into Gotham, lying in the falling rain in a construction site across from Milo's pharmacy, is the chained and unconscious Batman. Milo dangles the cure in front of Lupus, who begs his tormentor for just a tiny bit to help control the werewolf's curiosity.
Now give me that antidote. Please, just a taste.
No, not a drop. I want all the creature's savagery unleashed on the Batman.
Milo soon feels the full power as Lupus transforms and the werewolf turns on him. In the melee, Milo drops the only vial of the cure.
Outside, Batman awakens. Finding himself chained, the world's greatest escape artist finds a cotter pin and picks it up with his teeth. Just as he's about to free himself, the werewolf appears and leaps at the near-defenseless Batman. But the resourceful detective manages to headbutt his ferocious foe as he leaps forward, stunning him. This buys Batman enough time to free his hands, and soon their epic battle is begun in earnest. Batman soon finds he is outmatched by his feral foe when the werewolf slashes his chest and damages his other arm. The Dark Knight then decides to take the fight to his turf and climbs to the top of the nearby building skeleton as rain and lightning rage around him. But his advantage is quickly lost and a desperate Batman throws a sharpened metal rod at his foe. Much to Batman's shock, the rod pierces the beast's chest, although it doesn't seem to do much damage. As the inhuman creature pulls out the rod, lightning strikes it, seemingly electrocuting the creature, which falls many stories to the ground below. All Batman finds is a twisted and charred metal rod and no sign of his foe.
Sometime later in Alaska, legends begin of a wolfman, a hunter who spends most of his time hunting wolves and extracting their blood. But these tales say that on three nights of the full moon, the wolf pack grows thicker by one. One wolf with the shape of a man.
Len Wein was actually writing Swamp Thing at the time, which he co-created with Bernie Wrightson. But he has said, despite being a fan of Universal Horror, which they used a lot as a basis of their Swamp Thing work, that aspect wasn't as important to him as bringing back Professor Milo. Milo had only appeared in two Batman comics, but they were the first two that Wein had ever read. The Detective 247 and Batman number 112, they were both from 1957 and both written by Bill Finger and drawn by Sheldon Moldoff. So I know Janet is a Gotham gal, but wouldn't you think she'd be a little more shaken by anybody breaking in?
Well, you know, Batman or not. Come on.
Breaking into a window, you know. Not only is it a burglar on a very high story, but he's in a werewolf costume. I mean, maybe this is taking into account, hey, she lives in the DC universe. You know, there's flying people and, you know, it's not that out of the ordinary, I guess. I think, of course, the artwork by Neil Adams, it's Neil Adams. It's Neil Adams at the top of his game. So right. It's fantastic. But he makes Janet's dog, Ralph, look scarier than the werewolf. I mean, he's like really frightening looking when he's like coming at him, but it's really sad what happened.
And then again, maybe that's why Janet wasn't afraid. She got Ralph.
You know? That's true. Yeah, that's true.
He gonna eat you up.
I thought it was interesting. Batman crashes through the top part of Janet's window, even though the werewolf had opened the bottom sash already. It made me think of that line in the animated series where the Joker's like, either you don't know how to open a door, or you're just like pulling glass out of your shorts. You know, that's
right. And see, now Batman's caused property damage. I mean, windows aren't cheap.
Sorry about that.
You know?
Who's going to pay for my window?
They're not cheap.
Send the bill to the Wayne Foundation. Why? Just do it. Then Batman snaps her neck and we know.
Oh, Dad, what is wrong with you?
Justice. Sorry. The angle of the latent lycanthropy is a nice bit. I remember when I first read this. This was when I got this when I was like a teenager, about Andrew's age. And I was, you know, first going through puberty, and I was getting very hairy, you know, ahead of schedule. And like Andrew, and I was thinking, this is very scary. I mean, you know, it's like, I've got bushy eyebrows. I've got, you know, at least, because he's, you know.
Well, honey, you're like hair covered. You're like the missing link.
Yeah. So I mean, it's like, do I have latent lycanthropy? If I take the wrong serum, will I turn into a werewolf? I mean, I didn't really think that, but it, you know, it made, gave me pause briefly. I'm like, wait a minute.
Oh, crap.
Now, how did Lupus know Batman was going to hear about this? Because he said, did he have a drug drink just waiting on Batman for days? Did he have his gas set up, you know, so long in advance? I mean, plus, and we'll get into a different version of this story later, but in this version, it's just like he's spreading it, just talking about it.
Uh-huh.
So it's, you know, it just so happened that he talked to the guy that's really Batman when he talked to Bruce Wayne. You know, it's not like he advertised it.
Did he have to stay at home for the next 2 months every night waiting for Batman to show up?
Plus, why didn't the gas affect him?
I know, that's what I want to know. Why didn't the gas affect him?
Did he have like nose filters in? Did he have... did he take some kind of antidote?
His werewolf protected
him? Yeah, I don't know. So, you know, of course, the monster, the werewolf, turns on Milo. But despite this savage thrashing he gets here, he somehow returns in Batman number 256, which is also written by Len Wein.
Huh.
Len Wein really liked Professor Milo.
Why?
It's a childhood thing, you know. He encountered him early on. Yeah, you know, I do like Batman's trick with the cotter pin. That's classic Batman, you know, getting out of it.
Good stuff.
Yeah, and it wasn't something, you know, that was some goofy thing from his utility belt or something.
Yeah.
You know? One thing that, you know, the fight is really well done by Adams, very moody and atmospheric. But it surprises me that they got away with Batman throwing that rod through him.
Because he threw it hard enough. I mean, Batman's all about, you know, not killing somebody, but he threw it hard enough, it went through him.
Well, and you know, it's weird because last year we covered the story that's a few years after this with Gustave de Cobra, you know, the vampire that has his heart in the clock.
Oh, yeah.
And Batman impales him, and it doesn't do anything. It doesn't do anything to him because his heart's not there.
Right.
But they had it running through him, but he is undead. He's dead.
And he's a known undead.
He's a known undead. Batman even says he's dead, which brings up our point that we got into about the Skeeter story. Batman says, he's dead. I'm not killing him. He's already dead.
Right.
And Batman shoves it through him and doesn't kill him, but later he shoots the arrow through the clock and hits the heart. But this guy's alive. He's not dead. He didn't die and come back as a werewolf.
Mm-mm.
He's a living man that changes into a werewolf. So it kind of surprises me that they got away with it.
Batman's just jealous that he has facial hair and he can't have it because it's a defining feature. He's jealous.
Only when he's matches Malone. But yeah, it did surprise me that got past the comics code. This story, I really enjoy it, but it's kind of cut and dry. I mean, once you describe what happens in it, there's really not a whole lot to talk about it. You know, to points where our review here is seeming a little short. But Anthony Lupus, he actually returns in a comic I don't own, unfortunately, Detective Comics number 505. And that story is written by Jerry Conway and drawn by Don Newton. And that was right around the time I was really starting to get every issue of Batman and Detective. That was like right before.
Oh, okay.
And I don't have that, but maybe I'm going to have to track it down so we can do a sequel.
Something that gets me about it, I mean, and this isn't in the original notes that we made for the show, but Lupus. His name is Lupus.
Yeah.
I mean, and you're talking about marked periods of weakness.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of times it affects people because they get it because they've been very active. They get it from when they're hiking. They're, you know, there's different, you know, it just kind of, it's too on the nose.
Well, and lupine can mean canine as well.
Know.
Yeah. So, yeah, that was.
You know, Loopy, that was the name of when they did the Teen Wolf cartoon.
Yeah.
That was the name of his little sister. He had a little sister on the cartoon and her name was Loopy.
Well,
that's
probably why they changed it in the cartoon.
Yeah, which we're going to get into in just a minute. But that one's got a reference, too. But there was Loopy the Wolf, the Hanna-Barbera character, the French wolf.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, so it's...
That's a little too on the nose.
Yeah, well, I mean, but over at Marvel, they got a werewolf named Jack Russell. Okay? Yes. We talked about him last year. Remember Jack Russell, the werewolf by night? So, yeah.
Yeah, I concede.
Okay. Yeah. To me, this is Batman. You know, that Neil Adams and Dick Giordano's Batman was all over merchandise when I was a kid, including Power Records, which you can hear me and Rob Kelly talk about on the Power Records podcast. Even though Adams had moved on by the time I started buying the comic books proper, he was still the standard artist that others copied when it came to Batman. I mean, he was the definitive Batman of the era. And in fact, this is actually Neil Adams' final interior art on a Batman story until his somewhat maligned Batman Odyssey miniseries from a few years back, which is just
weird.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. He continued to draw him on covers and special merchandise, but this is the last story he did during the classic Bronze Age era. Let me ask you guys this. I love the art, and most of the coloring is very moody. I think Neil Adams usually had a hand in the coloring of you know direction of how the comics he worked on were colored. We don't have any credit for the colorist, and I couldn't find any on Mike's Amazing World. But the only thing that bothers me is the werewolf himself. On the cover, he looks fine because he's all one, pretty much one color, grayish brown. But inside, it's like it's not so much the brown. It's that red. It's that red, reddish brown that they. It looks like somebody took a magic marker and colored over top of the brown.
Oh,
it's very sloppy.
And then he looks green too.
Well, I think that's more just the limitations of the time,
the printing process
at the time. The brown does have a little green cast to it, but I mean, see, just like it's just sloppy, you know. And it's always bothered me. And I wonder, and this is just me speculating, but I wonder if at the last minute somebody didn't say, "Hey, he's got on green pants." And he's a werewolf. He looks a little bit like Marvel's Werewolf by Night. Maybe we ought to add different color to him because he was that color brown.
Oh.
So it makes me wonder if they, you know.
Didn't change it last minute.
Was a running change.
Yeah, if they didn't make a change to it. So now, of course, this story, as we mentioned earlier, was adapted into the Batman the Animated Series episode, Moon of the Wolf, by Len Wein himself. And Anthony Lupus becomes Anthony Romulus.
Still spot on.
Because Romulus and Remus,
the founders of Rome, they were raised by the wolves. And that's the whole point. And I'm just like, really?
Didn't Romulus kill Remus?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
I'm so proud of you.
That's our education system at work. In that version, Anthony Romulus is a lot less sympathetic than Anthony Lupus.
Yeah. Yes.
Because he comes to Milo for a steroid to enhance his performance.
Mm-hmm.
And Milo's like, well, the steroids are detectable, but I can concoct this, you know, derivative from Alaskan Timberwolves that won't be detectable. And he takes it. And that's what begins. There's no talk of latent lycanthropy in that episode because we just watched it right before we recorded this. and he gives him that, and that helps his athletic performance. He wins all of his medals, and then he basically kicks Milo to the curb, and then he's got an in-between phase of transformation where he's just really hairy, and he kind of looks like
he does though.
Thanks, guys. I was gonna say he looks quite a bit like Henry Hull in Werewolf of London, but fine. But anyway,
I love you. So. The other thing, this is just a little nitpick of mine, and I know it's in the Bruce Timm universe and a lot of the men are built that way, but runners are not that broad. I mean, that's the whole point. They are lean. They are, you know.
Right.
And it's not just him because he's taking steroids, but when it shows him competing, you know, running with the other guys.
Yeah.
All of them are these huge guys, and that's not how runners are
built.
Well,
now they are decathlon guys, but yeah, they're a little bit bigger than they should be probably for even decathlon.
Yeah, I mean, you know.
Well, you guys remember the Flash on the original TV show? He was like super buff.
Well, so, that's true.
Yeah.
Well, but now we've got little skinny Grant Gustin.
I still say little nitpicky thing.
Yeah.
And Grant Gustin, we are not. You do not throw off on him and call him skinny. He is lean. There's a difference.
Oh, okay. Now I see how it is.
But he's too young for me.
Oh, okay. Well, I hope so.
What? No.
Now, I will say that, you know, as you know, you won't find bigger fans of the animated series than here. I mean, obviously, we've done a lot of episodes on the animated series.
We have. I mean, it's almost the Bruce Timm podcast. I mean, let's be honest. I love Bruce Timm. However, this episode, especially, it's sloppy animation.
Yeah.
It's sloppy. I mean, that's the only way to describe it. It's weak. It's sloppy. It's like Andrew said, it's like watching a Super Friends episode.
Right. I mean, Milo's coat alone goes from brown to white, from brown to white to brown to white, from like literally from in the same scene from like shot to shot.
Yes.
I mean, it's like he's got a brown coat and then they show, he moves across the room and he's got a white coat. You know,
and
I mean,
Batman's got the white symbol.
Batman's got a white symbol. Maybe it was tying into Batman Returns with all the white bat symbol stuff all over.
I don't know.
No, I'm just kidding. Yeah, I mean, it's just and I don't really think they did. You know, the animated series could do atmosphere so well. I don't think that's a very atmospheric episode. It's not. I mean, like the Man Bat episode is far more creepy and atmospheric than this one. And it's got that kind of strange. Now, Bruce Timm said himself, he suggested that the composer use a guitar in it to give it kind of a different feel.
But see, and Andrew mentioned this too, when it first came on, the
it was weird. It was weird when it first started. Like, it was like, why?
Yeah, there's a few episodes in that series. There's that Joker one where he's got the garbage scowl that's putting out all the laughing gas, and it affects Alfred and it affects like all the people. And that one's got a weird soundtrack to it. It's got like da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da through the whole thing. It's like, yeah, it's like, so it's almost got like a dance beat to it, which is really strange. It's not that orchestral classic soundtrack, which I mean, I understand they did like 100 and some episodes.
And stepping outside of the box, but this is,
yeah, and I'm, you know, the design of the werewolf in that one, I could kind of understand why he's gray versus brown, although, you know, you can say, well, that's the guy's hair color, but Anthony Romulus has black hair and one hell of a unibrow.
Good Lord, dude, takes up like half his face.
Which, you know, which is interesting, but,
As far as other sound effects that are in there, you know, we talked about the soundtrack itself, but you mentioned about the jaw.
Yeah, there's one part where the werewolf opens and closes his jaw and it makes a rusty hinge sound. Yeah, it's like, what? It's like, I still like this episode because it is adapted from this comic and because it is cool to watch that one on Halloween. You know, which they would do that. They'd show that one on Halloween when they, you know. But I don't know. It's just they could have really done something really cool with this particular comic. And I feel like the animation, it's mostly from the animation studio, you know, overseas that did the animation. That's where the sloppiness comes in. But I even think on the BTAS team production side here in the U.S., it's not up to their usual standards. It's one of their mediocre, at best, episodes.
So was all the animation done overseas?
Yeah, they did the storyboards and everything here and then sent it over there to be animated.
Is it just because it's quicker?
Yeah, it's quicker and it's cheaper. And yeah. I mean, almost every TV show is done animated.
Still?
Yeah, the actual animation is done overseas. Filmation was actually the last holdout studio that animated literally everything here. Up until like the mid-80s, and then they sent one or two projects out, and then a few years later, they were out of business. So they actually got bought by another company that kind of shut them down, but
That way they got the rights of what they had, right?
Yeah, they basically bought their library. But yeah, so they were the holdout when Hanna-Barbera and all those others were sending stuff out overseas. So real quick, the Professor Milo in that episode was voiced by Treat Williams, which comic fans will remember from the scene chewing that he did in The Phantom as the villain in that movie.
Oh, that's who that was?
Yeah, yeah. And then, of course, he's been in a ton of other things.
Well,
But, and then...
Most notably, hair.
Yeah, he was in Hair. You're right. That's right. He was on that Everwood show we used to watch. Remember that?
Yeah, that was good.
Yeah. And then...
No, we never did see the last couple episodes.
I
think it switched to a different time or network or something, and we didn't get to see the...
Yeah, I don't know. That's that kind of just disappeared. It used to be the reason we watched it because it was on.
It was
around the same time as Smallville.
Yeah, yeah, and I think we watched it because to make sure we didn't miss Smallville, and it led into it. I think
or something like that. But and then the Anthony Romulus was voiced by Harry Hamlin, who was the
Harry Hamlin.
Yeah, Harry Hamlin. Yes, he was the Perseus in Clash of the Titans.
Oh, okay.
And was on L.A. Law and everything. But yeah, he was the voice of Romulus. And of course, I don't know who the voice of Batman was in that thing. It's hard to say.
The Batman.
That's right.
The voice of Batman.
He's still Batman in the Arkham games. What are you talking about?
I know. We're just kidding, guys, obviously. So anybody else got anything on that? On the comic or the animated episode? Yes, Batgirl's big surprise. We know Batgirl's. Batgirl. Yeah. Okay. Well, so, next, I think that's it for this time. So next time, we're going to go jump back from Universal back into Hammer. Oh, one more thing. Before we leave out of here, I realized I didn't mention this. In the Wolfman, Frankenstein Meets a Wolfman segment, I forgot to mention the fact that the poem, the famous poem, Even a Man Who Is Pure of Heart, is actually different in this movie than the first movie. Because at the end it says, when the autumn moon is full and bright, and this time it says, when the moon is full and bright. So they dropped the autumn part out.
So it doesn't have to be seasonal.
Right. So that, yeah, exactly. So they changed the poem. Or, of course, it could be just that grave robber just doesn't know the poem quite correctly.
Well, true.
But but I just wanted to bring that up, and I didn't last time. So,
gosh, Dad.
I know. So next time, we're actually going to jump from Universal to Hammer, but it's Hammer by way of Universal because Hammer's version of The Mummy, which is based on the Universal films. So it's based in part on the Karloff movie and then the subsequent movies that had first Tom Tyler and then Lon Chaney Jr.
Oh.
So that's after Universal and Hammer made their little deal and they started officially remaking some of their films. So we're going to take a look at it.
Well, and don't forget that the Frankenstein movie, and maybe we can even do an episode about that, there's a new Frankenstein movie that comes out at the beginning of October. Its release date.
No, I think they moved it to November.
We were talking about that
before. Yeah, it's like we said, it absolutely makes no sense that they don't put that out around Halloween. But yeah, it's in November.
My birthday.
It's in November. Yeah, that's the one with James McAvoy and Harry Potter, Daniel Radcliffe.
Who does Harry Potter play?
He's Igor.
Uh huh.
Oh, he's got the face.
He fixes it. No.
Oh,
honey, no.
Yeah.
No.
No, your mom. I know what your mom thinks. Like, he grew up nice, right?
No, I'm just saying he's a nice looking young man. I mean, it's just, it'd be like, no.
Yeah.
He's a kid, somebody, I don't care how old he is, can't mack on him. Watch him grow up. Don't care.
Okay.
Ew.
Okay, but yeah, he's Igor, and apparently Henry Frankenstein or Victor. It's Victor again. It's Victor, as in the book, Victor Frankenstein. Actually, because the name of the movie is Victor Frankenstein. He actually, repairs his body or whatever is what I understand. And then of course they get into the making of the monster. It actually, to me, it actually looks pretty interesting. It does have a kind of a Hammer vibe and a Hammer feel, like the Peter Cushing Dr. Frankenstein, where he's just so obsessed with what he's doing that he doesn't care what he does to get it done.
So the preview already came out or whatever?
Yeah, the trailer's out.
I've never seen it.
Yeah, it looks pretty good. I'm interested to see, I'd like to see somebody get, I know the Universal movies that the new cinematic universe are trying to start, which they said didn't start with Dracula Untold, then it did, and now it doesn't again because apparently Dracula Untold didn't, or whatever, is that what's the name of it? Dracula Untold?
Dracula Untold. Yeah.
It didn't quite go over as well as they'd hoped, but.
Mm. But to talk about, we are of course doing House of Frankenstein, and at the end of September, they're doing House of Transylvania. I mean, that tells you how much the monsters have.
I mean, Hotel Transylvania.
Hotel Transylvania.
Two.
And so that tells you, I mean, it went over well enough. They're making a second one. It's geared towards kids. I mean, they're, you know, it's the whole monster family. I mean, it's really cool.
Yeah, I like it.
Of course, we'll go.
Yeah, I like that. I like that first film. I wish it was a little more monstery. You know, I mean, it's not quite as spooky, atmospherically spooky as I wish it was. I mean, I wish there was a little bit of a Nightmare Before Christmas, Corpse Bride type vibe. Yes, you got a Nightmare Before Christmas shirt on.
But they're gearing it just a little bit younger.
Yeah, a little bit younger. So it's kind of like a modern version of Mad Monster Party.
Yeah.
Which there may or may not be something coming up about Mad Monster Party, but not here. I'll just put it that way. So
what?
So keep an ear out for that. But as we said, next time, come back. We'll talk about The Mummy and a surprise comic book that involves a superhero and, guess what, a mummy. So, we'll see you then. Bye.
Bye.
Supermates is a Franklin and Franken production in association with Bugaloo Enterprises Worldwide. The characters and properties mentioned in this show are copyright their respective holders. Likewise, all audio clips are copyright their holders and no infringement is implied. So please don't sue my mommy and daddy. Emails can be sent to supermatespodcast@gmail.com. Comments can be left at our blog at supermatescomic.blogspot.com. Find us on Facebook by searching for Supermage Podcast. Please consider leaving a review on iTunes. Thank you for listening to Supermates, the husband and wife geek cast.
The wine tonight is nobly blessed. Parola, parolin.
Parola, parolin.
By such a lady and her guest. Parola, parolin.
Parola, parolin.
To them I toast, come drink with me, that may they ever happy be, and may they live eternally. Parola, parola, parola. Come one and all and sing a song. Parola, parole. For life is short, but death is long. Parola.
Stop that!
Parola.
Stop it! Quit that singing, will you? Eternally. I don't want to live eternally. Why did you say that to me? Get away from me. Stay away. Go away, all of you. Let me alone!